Pain isn't pleasant, but you think it would be simple. Whether you stub your toe or break an arm, it hurts, and the source of the pain is obvious, an injury to your body. But pain can get complicated. For instance, chronic or long-term pain that may continue without detectable physical injuries. And pain is subjective. It's something you feel and have feelings about. And those are things that can be hard for medical science to measure, analyze, and treat. Douglas Nelson developed an interest in the subject of pain because he works with people suffering from pain as a massage therapist. He heads up Body Work Associates in Champaign, and he outlines what's known and not known about the science behind pain and pain treatment in a new book, The Mystery of Pain. I'm Jim Meadows. Doug Nelson is my guest on Focus today. We'll be talking about what pain is, how we experience it, and why so much of it is a mystery. That's on Focus after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Douglas Nelson is a licensed massage therapist with more than 30 years of experience. He's president of Body Work Associates, a massage therapy clinic in Champaign. He is the founder of NMT Midwest, which teaches precision neuromuscular therapy to other massage therapists. And Doug Nelson is the author of two books. The first one, Table Lesson, focuses on massage therapy that came out a couple of years ago. His second book, The Mystery of Pain, is new from Singing Dragon, an imprint of Jessica Kingsley Publishers, and it's pain that we'll be talking about today. Douglas Nelson, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, and good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it doesn't sound like a pleasant subject, but it is something that can be really very interesting. And one thing, just to get started, we're going to be talking about the science of pain and pain treatment, and you are not yourself a physician or a medical researcher. You're a massage therapist. How did you develop an interest in this subject?
Mm-hmm. Well, in a massage therapy setting, many of the people who come have some physical discomfort, and whether that discomfort displays itself in whatever condition it is, the common denominator to all of that was pain. When I asked myself what I really knew about that subject, the answer was a little underwhelming, because what I knew about that subject did not match always what the person was telling me. So my knowledge base about pain didn't explain what the person on the table was telling me about their experience, and something about that seemed inherently wrong. And the obvious thing is that my knowledge base is incorrect or a little weak. So really it started with just exploring what the science has to say about pain. The deeper I got into the subject, the more fascinating it was, and the story just kept unfolding and unfolding, and it at some point became a lecture, and then the lecture morphed into a book at some point. So,
well, we'll be taking your questions on pain throughout the show at 333-9455. Our toll-free number, if you're outside the 217 area code, is 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter as well. Now, I'm just wondering, as you got more into the science of it, did the science answer all your questions as far as, you know, the solutions you were trying to provide for your clients?
Right. In a way, the answer is not at all. I think anybody who dives into something deeply, what you end up with is fewer answers and better questions. And but that's the wonderful thing about this subject, is the deeper you go, the richer, the more fun in a lot of ways it is to research it, because there are so many questions. It's a little bit why I called the book The Mystery of Pain, because the difference between a mystery and a puzzle, for instance, is that in a puzzle you're missing a piece. If you just had one other thing, everything would be good. In a mystery, the pieces are in front of you. You just don't understand really what they mean. And pain is very much like that. It's very much a mystery. The researchers who are involved in this, there are lots of very interesting questions. The thinking has changed over the last 10 years, and the reality is in 10 and 15 years from now, we're going to think differently about it. It's an ever-changing process.
What ideas about pain and its treatment have you seen change over the years? What do people in the field no longer believe, or perhaps they've tweaked in mm-hmm. some way?
Yeah, great question. I think in some ways, Jim, part of that comes back to this idea there, in a sense, two kinds of pain. One is acute pain, and one is chronic pain, and they're really different. Acute pain in many ways is linear, that you have a stimulus and it produces this response, and then your body, which is experienced as pain, and then you have some response to this, which is to remove the offending stimulus or to do something about it. It's a very linear approach. The problem happens when people apply the principles of acute pain to chronic pain. And what's changed over the last few years is this understanding more deeply that chronic pain is something in and of itself, and the rules of one do not apply to the other. And it's a little dangerous when you apply those rules, because it seems confusing to family members or physicians. Why would you say that? Why in the world would that hurt? Because it would seem like from that stimulus, you shouldn't be in that much pain.
Well, when maybe you could talk a little more about people you treat, you work with, who suffer from chronic pain. And the difference from them is this is pain which is continuing.
Mm-hmm.
And is it also pain where maybe the source of the pain, sometimes it's known and sometimes it's not?
You nailed it exactly. Colloquially, when we use the term chronic, we always think of acute pain as short-term and chronic pain as long-term. One of the understandings about this, and this comes from the International Association for the Study of Pain, is that chronic pain may be pain that exists when the source, the cause of the pain, is no longer there. So the cause is gone, but the pain remains. That's in some ways maybe a better definition of chronic pain. And in some ways, think about how perplexing that is. If I have a thorn in my hand and I pull it out and then the pain goes away, it's all very clear. If I have some injury and then all of a sudden the pain remains when the thorn is gone, that's confusing for everybody.
Now, I'm wondering there, because, of course, pain, sensing pain isn't just automatic. You need a nervous system to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The nervous system goes throughout your body, and I think you go into this into your book. And the technical parts I got a little lost on as to exactly
what
in the nervous system transmits the feeling of pain that our brains pick up as pain.
Yeah.
Could an injury leave? Do we know anything about injury even after healing, leaving some lasting effect on the nervous system in that way?
Absolutely. Great question. So we have these neuroreceptors in the tissue called nociceptors, nocere meaning to harm. And they're really, we used to think of them as pain receptors. That's certainly what I was taught. But in some ways, maybe a better way to term it is a threat receptor. There's a really strange condition called congenital indifference to pain. These people, Jim, have no capacity to feel pain. But when their nociceptors are studied, some variants of this condition, their nociceptors actually work perfectly. So that means that the periphery is picking up this signal that says, ooh, there could be a problem in zone C. And it's sending that signal. That's what nociceptors do. But the brain is not interpreting that signal as pain. It may interpret it as pressure. So you have a cup in front of you. It doesn't have coffee, but let's say it did, and the coffee was scalding hot. You take a drink, and you say, oh, my goodness, I should never do that. These people would take that drink and feel just pressure in the back of their throat, which is why they don't live oftentimes.
And for these people, are you suggesting then that the problem isn't with the nociceptors failing to pick up the pain? It's with, I guess, the main brain, if we can think about it that way, failing to read it as pain and, in effect, tell you about it.
Exactly. And this is one of those cases where the aberrant thing actually teaches us a little bit about our daily experience, because our daily experience can be the same thing, that pain is not just a stimulus. And this is the model change. It used to be thought pain is a stimulus. Pain is not a stimulus. It's an experience. So In if you look at, again, the International Association for the Study of Pain, they say it's an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience.
That's one thing I wanted to ask you about, that uh-huh. being both sensory and emotional.
Yeah.
And how did this particular organization decide to put it in that context, not just being sensory?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And interesting, Jim, that they would use the word and instead of or. Right? Because the thorn seems to be sensory and sensory only, but the unpleasantness comes from the emotional centers of our brain, which then, if you look at fMRI studies of people who are in pain, the areas of the brain that light up largely have to do with emotions. So, and that's the unpleasantness of the situation. And so this is that line between the emotional experience of pain and just the abject physical experience of pain.
Getting back to people with chronic pain, people who come to see you, well, for instance, for starters, just as a massage therapist, what mm-hmm. do you do for them?
Yeah. So, you know, I might see people, in general, the people I see are, I feel like I'm this bridge person in a lot of ways, that the people that see someone like myself, they're going to work every day, they're doing what they're doing, they're running companies, they're taking care of their parents who have Alzheimer's, their young children, they're living their life, but they hurt. The pain that they have doesn't keep them from doing what they want to do, but they do it not with ease and oftentimes with amazing amounts of courage. So I'm dealing with people who hurt but who can still function, which is a little different than, you know, if you have terrible pain, you need to see your physician. This is a little different. So
are these people who just come to you on your own, or are they sometimes referred to you by doctors?
We get quite a few referrals, mostly from primary care physicians, but people can also come on their own also. And so that actually leads to a little bit of a problem, Jim, because one of the questions I have to ask myself is, what makes me think this is soft tissue in nature?
And let's unpack that. When you say soft tissue,
yeah.
meaning, what do you mean by that compared to mm-hmm. what?
Yes, that's right. So is this pain that they're experiencing something that is due to muscles, tendons, ligaments, or is this pain really coming from another source?
Which could be.
Like, for instance, if you have an infection in one of your organs, now this is interesting, with the nociceptors that we talked about, organs don't really have, they have very few of them. So what they use is something that has a lot of them, like your muscular system, as a way to, as a sounding board. So if you have a gallbladder problem, you may experience that as a pain behind your right shoulder blade. And you can imagine that someone might see someone like myself because you have pain behind your right shoulder blade. But the difference in that case might be what you would tell me is no position makes it worse, no position makes it better, nothing I can do either sets it off or relieves it. For me, red flags would go up.
And when it is an internal organ as compared to a muscle problem, it's not really something that massage can deal with.
No, you're off to the physician in short order.
And also, if it's a joint problem,
yeah.
if it's something to do with the bone or with the joints of the bone.
Yeah. So if you have like arthritis of the hip or arthritis of the knee, the soft tissue is going to respond to that, but that's effect, not cause. In that case, you need to deal with the joint issue, and all the soft tissue is a sequel of that.
But what you're saying is a lot of times that the pain may be expressed seemingly through the soft tissue. At least that's what it feels like.
That's right.
When you're feeling the pain, but that's not really what's causing it.
And that's here's where it gets complicated. I think as Mencken, who said, there's, you know, every complex question has a simple, direct, and wrong answer. Mm-hmm. So with the soft tissue thing, let's imagine that, for instance, you have arthritic changes in your knee. Now the soft tissue responds. But here's where the whole pain thing gets interesting, because the soft tissue then actually makes the arthritic changes or the knee pain worse, right? So the question is, how much of the pain, if 100% is all of your pain, how much of the pain is coming from the joint? How much of the pain is coming from the surrounding soft tissue? And one is talking to the other. And so sometimes what you'll see is somebody who is younger and maybe doesn't need a replacement, but the soft tissue work will make them more functional and reduce their pain level by quite a bit.
But that's not, when you're talking with a joint problem.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So you'd think if it's a joint problem, it's a joint problem, and only, you know, for instance, maybe a replacement is going to solve it. Not always the case. You know, you could maybe make someone much more comfortable.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about pain with massage therapist Douglas Nelson. He's president of Bodywork Associates in Champaign and author of the new book, The Mystery of Pain, published by Singing Dragon. If you have questions and comments, call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email your questions to us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. We should note if you're calling with a question about your own pain issues, please remember some limits since you can't really offer detailed individual advice over the radio. But we're getting back to people with chronic pain. There are certainly going to be cases where the chronic pain is something to do with muscle tissue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what's causing it in that case? Are there still mysteries involved?
Well, there are still mysteries involved in that. But sometimes what happens with the soft tissue is, again, here's one thing that's been studied, Jim. If you have back pain, for instance, and maybe you have had this muscle spasm, and or maybe a disc was a little inflamed and now there's a sequel of events that happens and there's a muscle tightness, you would think that 2 months later, when the back spasm is no longer there, that you've gone back to your normal functioning and muscles are responding normally. The data is in the other direction, that it's a software problem. Like the brain has rewritten the software and you use things differently. I saw someone just a little while ago, and she had had a cast on her leg from a fracture, and she's still walking with a limp, but she has absolutely no pain. How is that?
And there's nothing wrong with the structure of her leg.
No. And the weird thing is that if you walk differently, then, of course, that sets up a whole series of events and you eventually could actually create pain. So it's more a software problem than a hardware problem.
You have to maybe consciously teach yourself to walk without a limp again.
Yeah. And so there is that questioning of what am I doing? Why am I doing it? And turns out there's some really good data that focusing on those sorts of things is quite helpful in rewriting that software.
We have a caller coming in on line four, Lou, and I have it written down as from Herrick here, but good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. I've kind of learned through experience with people that pain isn't really a good word to use. It seems like tensity is maybe more descriptive because a feeling some people might enjoy at one level, once it gets past a certain of intensity, they use the word pain.
Mm-hmm.
You run into this.
This is a very interesting idea. You know, words have power, and once you sort of name it, it has implications. It has power. If I say, for instance, the word pain has implications, and Jim's interpretation of pain and my interpretation of pain is quite different, and you can imagine that varies from person to person. One of the things in measuring pain, there is this, pain scale on a scale of 1 to 10. One person I know who's a nurse anesthetist, Wally, just amazing guy. What he does, instead of asking people that, he asks people on a scale of, I think it's 1 to 7 or 8, how comfortable are you? That switches everything around. You're still asking in a way for the same information, but you've framed it differently. And it turns out the frame changes things.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Great question.
And that is, I think you used comparison in the book. I think I read it there about scratching an itch, which, when you're scratching, you are getting close to tearing into the skin.
Mm-hmm.
If you do it really hard, it could definitely be painful, but at a lower level, dealing with yet a separate source of discomfort, it's not.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? And I have to say, I take a little perverse pleasure in this, Jim, because many of my friends here are involved in neuroscience at the university, and this question just drives them crazy, and somehow I love that. And the thing is, how does the brain know hurt from harm? You scratch that. If I scratched your arm now with the same intensity, you'd probably whack me. But if you had some bite or something, it feels just delicious. How in the world is that? And how does the brain know the difference? Boy, if that doesn't define mystery, I don't know what does.
And that goes on with the idea about measuring pain. You mentioned, and you go into the book about the difficulties mm-hmm. of measuring pain and the difficulties it poses for people who are trying to study pain because it is so subjective.
Absolutely.
You can't go put a little electrode on somebody's nervous system and watch the little electromagnetic currents going along and saying right. pain's up to 45 dBs or whatever.
Right. Wouldn't it be nice? But
I mean, and I want to check on that. Is there any way of measuring any neurological mm-hmm. or nervous system activity mm-hmm. having to do with pain?
Yeah. Boy, I have such conflicting feelings about this.
I take it some people think there are?
Well, see, some new research that's just out using fMRI. Remember I told you about the fMRI studies and different zones in the brain?
fMRI meaning?
Functional magnetic resonance imaging. It's really like measuring blood flow in parts of the brain. So just in the last couple months, Jim, there's been this research that there's some promise that you can actually look at one of these studies and predict how much pain someone is in. That sounds like a really good thing. I'm a little fearful about this because in the biomedical model, there is this thing, if I can't see it, you don't have it. You know. So in the subjective thing where if I ask you on a scale of 1 to 10 or if you tell me you're in pain, the kind of the rule in pain stuff has been the patient is in exactly as much pain as they say they are. My fear is with some of the technological things that will get misinterpreted in the, well, if your fMRI doesn't show that, then, Jim, you must be lying or making it up. And I think one of the things that I've seen with people in pain is they've been invalidated so many times that if you talk to people, and I interviewed many people for this book, I didn't decide to do the book like that, but when you interview people in pain, invalidation is a very common theme that comes up.
Have you talked with a lot of people as a massage therapist who have problems with pain, who just have trouble getting people to take them seriously?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, Jim, what's really sad about that is having done this now for 36 years, some conditions, you know, people will describe this condition, and because the healthcare provider didn't have the model of understanding to interpret that, they just wiped it off as secondary gain. You're making this up. Somehow you're benefiting from the pain, only to find out science-wise later, oh my goodness, there's a condition called whatever. Now it has a cool Latin name. And all of those people who we dismissed actually, we're suffering from something real. There's a long history of these kinds of conditions. So the bottom line is, at some level, you must take people at face value. But then, of course, this becomes a problem. And this is, for physicians, what a nightmare. First, we tell them that you're not listening to us. Then they get from the other side, well, there's too much, you know, dispensing of opioids and the poor physicians can't win in this thing, and I feel bad for them.
Does it ever work, what you mentioned, the idea of people feeling pain while the scientific instrumentation cannot measure it? Does it ever work the other way around, where the scientific measurements would say this person should be in a great deal of pain, but the person doesn't feel that much pain?
Oh, absolutely.
Or doesn't report feeling that?
Yeah. What's weird is, in the simplest way, I just had somebody the other day who had an X-ray taken of their back, and the physician said, you know, I'm so sorry, you must be in terrible back pain. And they said, why? My back never hurts. And then the physician said, well, look at this. The X-ray looks terrible. You've got all these arthritic changes and whatever. And yet this person has never experienced back pain. My fear with the what's called nocebo effect, the negative effect, I hope they don't develop it. But so that's a flip where someone should be in pain, but they're not. And it turns out diagnostic tests like that are not good predictors of pain.
Well, you're working with people who are feeling pain. They may not be able to find a source of the pain. Mm-hmm. What can be done for them? Starting with your own profession, but maybe mm-hmm. going beyond that too. What sort of help can they get?
Yeah. Well, let's take something like that person who has back pain, for instance. There are many things that influence this. One of them would be, for instance, one of the classic things that happen when people are in pain is what's called kinesiophobia, or fear of movement. So if it hurts to move, you stop moving. As it turns out, that's a disastrous strategy. I don't know.
Is that just for soft tissue pain, or is it more like, I've certainly heard it in the case of arthritis, that really it's good to keep moving, and even though there may be some initial discomfort.
Absolutely, and the same is true for back pain. I'm old enough to remember when bed rest was a common prescription for back pain. Now no one does that because the studies have shown that's a disastrous strategy. But the tendency is, if it hurts, then I'll restrict my movement. As it turns out, restricting that movement kind of cascades you down a road that's not going to help you. So if someone comes, for instance, whether it's someone like myself and I actually work with them and show them, well, it's not everything you heard over here, but this actually is good and this is good and you can do this and you can do that, it kind of erodes that idea that my back is trashed and it's going to fall off and, you know, I'm going to die. But you find out that you're actually a little better than you thought, and you have a little clearer map in your brain of your body. And it turns out there's some really great research on that these days.
In terms of, can you go a little further into that research in terms of?
Yeah. So what happens with pain, one of the interesting things is pain creates what's called sensitization. And peripheral sensitization is something where nerves get super sensitized, and it's not, it's hyper sensitized, and also the location is imprecise. So sometimes when someone comes into me and I ask them where they hurt, they'll like make this sweeping gesture over their whole upper quadrant and say there. And I'll say, well, can you be a little more specific? And they'll do the same sweeping gesture, like, you know, that's okay, that's a quarter of your body. The problem is, I would think to myself, well, this person's just totally, you know, unaware and doesn't know their body. Actually, neurologically, it makes perfect sense. And this has been studied again from the FRI studies, that honestly, that person's map, we all have a little internal map of our body, has been altered by the pain experience. And any, like my, whether I'm doing that with my hands, whether someone's doing that through yoga, Pilates, Tai Chi, ballroom dance, somehow if they're rewriting the software and re-experiencing their body, that turns out to be quite beneficial and quite important, actually.
In your book, The Mystery of the Pain, you come right out and write that you don't deal with the use of drugs to treat pain, saying that's one way to approach it, but that yours is also a path for treatment. What's the difference between them in terms of what you see as the potential and the limitations?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a place for everything. You know, people always ask me, do you believe in whatever? And it's not about a matter of belief. It's in some ways a matter of data. And there's really a great place for pain medications. The reason that the book has nothing to do with that, the best reason is I don't know anything about it. Two, it's not in my scope of practice. And three, if you're interested in that, there are so many great publications that can teach you more about, you know, pharmacology. I'm kind of interested in other approaches to that that can be used in conjunction, you know, sometimes in replacement, but it's not about replacing. It's always about what works. So the hands-on, if you have musculoskeletal pain, for instance, pharmacology is one way to do that. But really what you're doing is dampening it kind of at the perceptual level, at the source. In exploring the tissue, there are, for instance, something called trigger points. And in the trigger points, a little hyper-irritated spot in the muscle that will refer pain somewhere else. So you might have something in your shoulder that is creating pain at the base of your occiput, which presents like a headache. Headache meds are probably, this is not an aspirin deficiency. This is something that someone who's skilled can actually press on that spot in your shoulder and recreate your headache immediately. And this has been around for a long time, Jim. The first studies, Kellgren did this in 1932, where he injected into the tissue a little isotonic saline and could recreate these referral patterns pretty consistently.
Okay, and the upshot of, you know, the upshot of that, using the trigger points, can that be used to relieve pain in itself?
Absolutely. As long as, and here's the kicker, as long as trigger points are the source of those things. And how do we know that you can replicate it by digital pressure?
And is this something that massage therapy has been working with for centuries, I guess?
Yeah, well, for a long time. And the science about that is just becoming richer and richer. Now, for instance, Dr. Jay Shaw at the National Institute for Health is doing this amazing work where, with again, as the technology gets better, for the first time in human history, you can actually see these things with a new ultrasound technique in live tissue, which also means we'll be able to see a before and after. This has never been done before. This is an exciting time.
Before and after, meaning you can see something in the tissue, I take it maybe in the nervous system of the tissue.
Yeah. In the tissue itself.
Responding to the touch and showing the absence of discomfort afterwards if treatment is successful.
So these trigger points, Jim, have been studied by, you know, resecting them out of animal tissue. So we can look at the tissue, but you've cut it out of something. You can't put it back, even if you keep the receipt. So what's more important, what's possible now, is that you can see them in living tissue. You can actually treat it. And what you would know as a patient is your headache went away. But the research question is, what happens to the actual thing in the tissue? And that's never been known and no way to know it. Now it is. And so stay tuned. It's only going to get better.
We're going to take a short break, and then we will return with more talk about pain with massage therapist Douglas Nelson. He's the author of the book, The Mystery of Pain. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus as we continue our conversation with Douglas Nelson, a massage therapist and president of Bodywork Associates in Champaign. And he's the author of the new book, The Mystery of Pain. It's published by Singing Dragon. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455, toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. In line one, we have Bob from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning, sir. I would like for you to address the subject of inflammation, where inflammation comes from, and how inflammation contributes to pain. I'll listen to your talk on that.
Okay, Bob, thank you very much. And now we really are talking about something that directly physically affects tissue.
Mm-hmm. And something that, here we go again, that the current research, boy, it's just changing and unfolding. I know there are people here at the U of I who are toying with the idea of really exploring this because, number one, pretty much we thought we understood what inflammation is and sort of the cascade of events that follows. And if you cut your finger and you go through this, you know, period of neurobiological activity that is inflammation, that's pretty well understood. But what's not understood well is this low-level inflammation that goes on for a long period of time. And there is just some amazing research happening in that level, and it's not clear yet. I hate to do that to the caller, but honestly, it's an area of really interesting research that you may have read things like, you know, even dental infections and having an effect on cardiac issues, and it just has more implications than anyone had ever thought, and there's some really great research coming in this, and I would think that in the next 4 to 5 years, we're going to have a much better understanding of this, but it is far greater than anyone thought.
You're saying that inflammation of tissue can certainly have an effect on pain issues, mm-hmm. maybe going beyond the direct area of inflammation?
Absolutely. So what happens is, and we go back to this thing called sensitization. So what part of what if you, for instance, get a sunburn, and that actually, you know, creates some inflammation of the skin. Taking a shower after that is not a pleasant experience, right? But the water isn't any hotter than you'd normally experience it, but it is just a horrific experience because this you're oversensitized. So this is one of the things that inflammation does is sensitize the nervous system. And again, there are two ways to do this. You can sensitize it peripherally, and you can sensitize it centrally in the central part of the brain.
Sunburn is a really obvious inflammation.
Right.
You may be talking about things which are a little more trickier to detect,
Yeah.
either by doctors or by the the person who's suffering mm-hmm. from it.
Like tendonitis, for instance, tennis elbow, lateral epicondylitis. Now, for instance, there's this really good evidence that it's not an itis like we thought, not the typical kind of inflammation, but other things that are happening at other levels. It's an area of really great research, and I think 4 years, things are really going to change.
Is that something that you see more knowledge coming mm-hmm. out in the mm-hmm. next few years?
There's a lot of research interest in this.
Let me go to another caller on line one, Sherry in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. I wonder what you could tell me about fibromyalgia.
I would call it the poster child for the mystery of pain. And the reason I would say that is that, let me describe it this way. Maybe 30 years ago, Aunt Martha was just someone who complained a lot, and I'm making this up, but Aunt Martha was somebody who complained a lot, and everyone in the family knew she was always hurting. She didn't participate in all the activities like everybody else. It was just kind of crazy Aunt Martha. And then Muhammad Yunus, University of Illinois, and some other people really helped clarify the diagnostic criteria for this thing called fibromyalgia syndrome. And it was accepted as a diagnosis. Everything is good. More is understood about it. But here's the problem with that. And this is where we get into the sort of medical fashion or the pendulum. Now what happens is that there are other people who have chronic pain, and they don't really fit exactly that model. But if you hurt, you want a name for it. So they would press their physician, well, why do I hurt? And give me a name for it. And oftentimes that name was fibromyalgia, misdiagnosed. So now what happens is other physicians who are very smart and understand the criteria, maybe 3 to 4 out of 5 people that they see who are diagnosed with fibro don't actually fit that criteria. So instead of questioning the diagnosis, they question the condition. So now the sad thing about that is Aunt Martha goes from invalidated to validated to invalidated, because now you have even family members and other people say, oh, they called it fibromyalgia because they don't know what's wrong with you and they wanted to give it a name. If you look at the research criteria, and there's some really great research coming out of the University of Michigan has done a really great job with this, the criteria for diagnosing for actually how the brains of people who have fibro are different, there's some really clear diagnostic criteria. Here's the problem. That diagnostic criteria is not applicable in the clinic because it's incredibly expensive. This is not something that your average physician is going to have available to them. So fibro is real. It's misunderstood, often misdiagnosed, and it's actually kind of a sad situation. So that's why I call it the poster child for the mystery of pain.
Sherry, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So if you were diagnosed with this and you wanted your doctor to do that last bit that you said they could do some kind of test to...
Yeah, not really. There are, in research laboratories, there are tests that can be done that and there's some really great stuff about that. In the book, there's a whole chapter on this, how the brains and of people who have fibro are different, but that's not really available to the average physician, only in the research realm. And that's maybe someday. I'm sure that will change, actually.
Oh, I see what you're saying. It's kind of just an experimental thing right now.
Exactly. It's just expensive. That's the problem.
So what sort of treatment is realistically at hand for people?
For fibro? One is you need to find a doctor who understands the condition, has experience with this. There are definitely some pharmacological things. One of the hallmarks of people who have fibro, for the healthy, normal person, if you go out and you start an exercise, I get out of my bike. For the first 3 miles, I have about 40 excuses per mile of why today isn't the right day to ride. But then after I keep riding, I keep feeling better, right? That's called descending inhibition. We all know this, and especially in exercise. Well, actually, someone who has fibro, they don't have descending inhibition.
It doesn't work.
So, yeah, exactly. You just feel even worse. Now you feel, terrible.
Yep.
And if you deal with, for instance, a physical therapist who doesn't understand these conditions, the therapist will push you, like, come on, are you just... Mm-hmm. just suck it up and, you know.
So it's not like having a little arthritis and just trying to walk through
it. It's totally different because their brains are totally different. But exercise is actually really important for them, but it's got to be done in a very careful, calibrated way. And you just need to find people who really understand the science and
how
can help
you. How do you do exercise in a carefully calibrated way to help people in this
way? Yeah, and that's a great question to ask your physical therapist.
Okay. Sherry, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
And we were talking about, I should remind people that we still have a few minutes left for your questions and comments. For Douglas Nelson and the subject of pain and pain treatment, the number is 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're talking here in these cases about inflammation where there is something going on in the body that's telling people they have reasons to be in pain. Mm-hmm. We were also talking about earlier in situations where the brain may be picking up something, whether or not there's really anything being sent. And mm-hmm. I think that's where your book gets into areas like the ideas of how the brain processes whatever pain it's receiving. And one of the subjects you bring up is attentiveness. And what do we mean by that?
Attentiveness means kind of, first, let me just jump back one step, Jim. A lot of that data that's coming up to the brain has to assign meaning to it. So I'll give you an example. Yesterday, one of my clients was late. You know who you are. And so I had a few minutes, and so I ran outside. And there's this area in back of my office. There were a bunch of weeds. And I thought, I'm going to finally take care of this. So I reach in, I'm pulling these weeds, and all of a sudden, ouch, my hand hurts. And I look down and I see this thorn sticking out of my hand. And so I pull the thorn out and I keep weeding. And then all of a sudden, again, wow, that hurt. And I look at my finger and I see no thorn. And I don't know if you can see a little red mark there. I'm telling you, that thing really hurts. Now, the interesting thing about it is, you know where the thorn was? I'm looking at my hand. I can't even tell you. But where that other little guy is, that actually really hurts. Because here's the thing. The brain does funny things. It's probably the same thing, but I'm thinking old weeds, there were cobwebs there. What if it's a brown recluse and you know what's going to happen? Then my finger's going to fall off and then my arm's going to fall off and then I'm going to go bankrupt and lose the house, the office, and you know. The brain just cascades down this road all because I'm assigning meaning to a stimulus. And sometimes we assign errant meanings to things. So that is this weird thing between meaning and how we assign those things.
And can that really affect the seeming intensity of pain?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So
and part of this is also dealing with fear as well.
Absolutely. And if there's anything that accelerates the experience of pain, Jim, fear is the thing that does it the most. For instance, maybe you clean out the garage and you're really tired and whatever, and now you have pain. That's fine. And you think, oh, you know, the garage was really dirty. But think about somebody else who maybe has a history of low back pain, or somebody else who had some cancer and now they have pain that feels like back pain, but they're thinking, oh, maybe this is spinal pain. Oh, maybe there's a metastasis. Maybe this is bone cancer. You know, you can take the same experience and the same stimulus and have a completely different experience about it.
How do you tell people how to deal with this?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things is you have to be very careful about your expectations. There's one really interesting fMRI study where what they do is place a really hot piece of metal on the person's arm. And it is hot enough it's seriously unpleasant, but not enough to cause tissue damage. And then they look at the brain's response to this. And then they place a lukewarm plate on your brain, and then they look at that response. And then they tell you, okay, here's the hot one again. They put it on, and if you look at the MRI, it looks just like it's hot, except it's lukewarm. What you get, you expect. We have to be careful about that.
Okay. Let me go to another caller, Line 1, Don and Sullivan. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Thank you for taking my call. Great program this morning. I am curious about what your guest has to say about a condition called polymyalgia rheumatica. I'm understanding that it involves not only muscular tissue and inflammation, but also joints too, as in the rheumatic. Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you very much, Don.
Yeah, I'm only moderately familiar with this, and I'm acutely aware of my limits of knowledge with this. It's something I need to know more about. So I hate to respond that way, but that's the truth. I need to understand this better, and that's a particular condition that I don't feel like I understand completely. That's the reality.
Is that a condition you've come up with in people you've worked with as a massage therapist?
It's funny. Twice in the last 2 weeks. So something in the is keep putting this in front of me saying, okay, buddy, you need to learn more about this.
That's your homework assignment.
That's right. That's right. I have a lot of them.
Caller left a message with us. He would like you to talk about pressure points. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this also deals with the triggers that you were talking about mm-hmm. earlier, but pressure points, which have some sort of function doing with pain, whether it's relieving or causing mm-hmm. or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a couple of different kinds. So when we talk about trigger points, the word trigger means the action pulling the trigger is one place, the effect is somewhere distal. So sometimes those words get used interchangeably, and they're not. A trigger point is something, when pressed upon, creates an effect somewhere else. There are something called tender points, where it's just tender to the touch. That means some localized problem. But there are also sometimes, I don't know if this person's asking about pressure points in terms of the acupuncture sort of or Asian medicine kind of thing, and that could be what they're referring to.
Well, are there pressure points that people in massage therapy use? Mm-hmm. And I know there are. I looked it up on Wikipedia, which may not mm-hmm. be the definitive right. source, but they came up with dozens of different types of massage therapy.
Yeah, of course, and the spectrum is really wide. But when you look at pressure points, there are some commonalities just because of just our both functional anatomy and just gross anatomy. There are some commonalities where people tend to have problems, but it depends on really the model of thinking that goes into what makes that point. But a trigger point is something that creates an effect somewhere else. That's quite different.
Okay, and I'm wondering, like for instance, in the techniques that you teach through now I've forgotten the initials.
Yeah. Well, NMT Midwest.
Do they have a particular approach as far as the subject is concerned of pressure points?
Yeah, we do actually. We teach work with trigger points, but it's not just limited to that. Years ago, it was, but what I find is if I look at what I taught 15 years ago, it would be. You could subtitle it, I have a fabulous answer and I'm looking for a question that goes with it. And I think these days I'm more interested in what's actually the question. How is the decision-making process that therapists make? And people in my field don't always realize they're making decisions. We all make decisions. Why do we choose one thing over another? What's behind that decision? What does the science have to say? What does our clinical experience have to say? Because what we're trying to create is a predictable outcome. And it turns out that's not a very easy thing to do.
Another caller leaves us a request if you could talk about complex regional pain syndrome.
Oh, boy.
That is a thing, I take
it. Oh, it is. It's a nightmare is what it is. So this is peripheral sensitization gone crazy. So now even if you have it in your leg, for instance, so you, right now, you know, your pant leg brushing against your skin, you don't even think about it. In complex regional pain syndrome, what happens is that is perceived as a threat. And every stimulus is perceived as a threat. And it is an absolute nightmare once you get to that level.
Is it painful as such?
Oh, horrifically painful.
You're saying
painful.
As a threat.
Yeah.
I mean, is it something that is your mind going to say that really hurts?
Absolutely. It is incredibly painful.
Even though no injury is being done to you.
Often it starts with some sort of injury and then it just cascades down the road and it becomes, it's a nightmare. And I mean, it is seriously painful.
When you say regional, so it may be limited perhaps to one part of the body where the injury occurred.
Right.
So if you had a bad leg injury of some sort. You were shot, a shrapnel wound, you were in an auto accident, a wild animal bit you, something like that could trigger it?
It would stay contained to that area.
Is that something that you can work with as a massage therapist?
Honestly, it is one of the most difficult conditions to deal with that you could possibly. The thing is to try to do everything not to let it get to that point, but oftentimes it's a cascade of events, and it is the most difficult thing I could imagine working with.
And that raises the question, so what we were talking earlier, is this an issue of something went wrong with with the nociceptors, the nerves down there in the leg, since we're talking about the leg? Or did something go haywire in your brain, so to speak, which is digesting this information and saying that the slightest touch is pain?
Right. And the answer is yes.
To both.
To both.
Or both, so, or one or the other, we don't know.
It's both. So here's what's a couple of years ago, I thought this was brilliant. I'll never do it again because they didn't perceive it this way. But I was teaching a class and we're talking about peripheral sensitization. And I told this class in hotel that I'd forgotten to mention that the hotel told me that they had a problem with roaches and that they need to get all personal information and foodstuffs and anything off the floor. It was chaos for 4 minutes. Then later, I kept glancing around the room. About 15 minutes later, I asked the class if anyone besides me had seen a roach. Probably half the class raised their hand because they thought they'd seen one, right? You get what you expect. And then I fessed up on the ruse, and they didn't actually seem to like that very much. I'll never do it again. But it made the point about peripheral sensitization. If you expect that something is a threat or a problem, you start seeing roaches where there are none.
You say the word peripheral, meaning?
Meaning, at, like, for instance, if the injury's in your lower leg, it'll be contained to that area. But then it feeds to the central nervous system that says, oh my goodness, there's a problem down in zone Z, and then I should be hypervigilant, and then the two things cascade on each other.
I don't know if that answers the question, but it is a real problem. It's not just something you're dealing with in theory.
It's a real problem.
Well, we're out of time.
Unbelievable.
And Doug, I want to thank you very much for being with me today. We've been talking with Douglas Nelson, author of The Mystery of Pain, published by Singing Dragon. Mr. Nelson is a licensed massage therapist and president of Bodywork Associates in Champaign. And Doug, thanks for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. Go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show produced by Lindsay Moon, other members of our Focus team, Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick, Jason Croft, our technical director. Bats on Monday's Focus and the problem of white nose syndrome affecting bats in the Midwest and throughout North America. We'll be talking in an encore presentation for March. Ecologist Ed Heskey from the Illinois Natural History Survey. That's on Monday's show. Thanks for listening. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.